The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It's nice to see all of you this afternoon. Thanks for coming.
Oh, you need a microphone. Oh, okay.
Yeah, you need a microphone. Yeah,
all right.
They could probably hear you back there with that one, though.
Well,
I am pleased to be here, and
thanks to you for coming.
And I'm just very excited to talk to you because, first of all, I'd love to hear you speak because
you have such a beautiful voice.
I lived in the South for a long time. I was a big fan of Southern literature, and the first thing I wanted to ask you today is why is it that Southern people are such great writers? Why? What is it about that region of the country?
Well, there are a lot of explanations for that. One of them traditionally has been that there are so many Southern writers because there are not as many Southern readers. And you can write about your neighbors without their knowing. Another thing, it's like Southern writers are like boxing kangaroos. You know, they have kangaroos that box. It's not that so many kangaroos are boxers. It's just that when there is a kangaroo who's a boxer, you can always tell that it's a kangaroo. Just that, you know, Southern writers tend to show up more than capture attention. Northern writers kind of come and go, but Southern writers, everybody says, that's another Southern writer. It may have been 100 years since the last one, but people recognize them.
Is there something about the food, though? What is it?
Well, I mean, Southern culture has always been a very oral culture. So there's lots of talk out there, you know, that hasn't been written down yet. I mean, Philadelphia, I imagine, is a much more, written culture. And much in New York, at any rate, I spent a lot of time in New York, and every time you open the door, you hit another writer with it, you know. But
right.
In the South, when you open the door, it's probably people talking about something that's not copyrighted, and you can just steal it. And it's the difference between, I mean, I live a lot of time, most of the time now up in New England, and when you come into a New England country store, people come in, they're like this, you know, they're saying, "Ooh, God, it's cold outside." Whereas in a Southern country store, people come in saying, "Ooh, Lord, it's hot," you know, and just sort of, so it's more expansive, and there's more conversation. And people in the South also enjoy playing around with words, you know, and sort of don't take words for granted at all. I was in the airport in Nashville a while back, and the woman, and I bought a newspaper, and the woman behind at the cash register was sniffling. And I said, "Oh, looks like you're catching a cold," and she said, "Oh, I hope not. I've already got one," which kind of thing that people in the South might say. Yeah.
One thing I always want to ask a person of your stature is, do you have carpal tunnel syndrome or any sort of writing issues? Because you spend so much time writing. Are you getting a massage all the time?
I wish. Well, I don't. I'm actually kind of restless and fidgety, and probably maybe that's why I haven't seized up yet. I don't know. I hate to think I would get carpal tunnel syndrome. I have worn the little dots on your, or I guess it's just one dot on your keyboard where you know what to put your left index finger. I've worn that off, so I now find myself wandering around the keyboard and typing the wrong things. So that keeps me just off balance enough that I don't get stiff, I guess.
Are you a Mac or a PC?
I'm a Mac. I'm a Mac person. My wife and but my son and my wife both were Mac people and talked me into it. And I now have an iPhone and an iPad. In fact, I just got an iPad. I was actually going to bring, but. And I like it a lot. It's more like reading a book than the Kindle is. I like it. But I bought my own book to put on there so I could read from it. You know, carry it around. It's easier to carry around than your own book. But I just was on the train today, and I punched up my own book, and it said not available or something. So, I mean, I'd already bought it. It was there 2 days ago, so I'm wondering whether the iPad still has some bugs. Hmm. Also, here's another thing that happened to me with the iPad. I called up to the, I was having a little trouble accessing something on it, and I called, my wife talked me into calling the assistance, you know, calling the, whatever you call it, the help, online help, and I called the number, and the machine started asking me questions, you know, and it said, which Apple product do you want to talk about? And I said, iPad, and the, it said something like, I understand complete sentences. Said, and then he said, do you mean the magical and revolutionary iPad? And I said to him a rude sentence. How's that? I said, after saying it, for a complete sentence. And I just threw it down. I'm not going to let them put words in my mouth like that. So my wife took over and dealt with it. Is it the magic and historical iPad you want to talk about? God, I just hate, you know, I hate when you go on to Amazon and there's a little thing that says, Roy's stuff. You know, they don't know anything about my stuff.
Maybe they do, though.
Well, they probably do, but I'm not going to admit it.
Well, I was going to ask you later on about the Kindle and your role as the president of the Authors Guild, what your opinions of the Kindle in general as both a voice of authors and author yourself as a reader.
Yeah, I've been the president of the Authors Guild for the last 4 years, which means that my term is just about up. Scott Turow is taking over. But in the course of that, lots of things have happened. I thought it was going to be a ceremonial post, you know. People would attach ribbons to my head and dance around me or something. But it turned, we sued Google, you know, and then we sued everybody who might have any control over my future as an author, in fact. And one of the people, we haven't sued Amazon, but Amazon put out the Kindle, which includes when you buy the Kindle, it will read books aloud to you if you download the e-book. And we took the position that that was competing I could record my own books, you know, my own audio books. And we took the position that this denatured voice that competes with audio books. But we made it clear that it should be available to the blind or anybody has. You know, reason not to be able to buy, to do audiobooks, or anybody who can't read should be, by sight, should be able to get it for free. I've recorded lots of my books for free for the Lighthouse of the Blind. But somehow or another, the American Federation of the Blind decided that we were discriminating against the blind by coming out, I don't know, so they picketed. I heard they were going to hang me in effigy. And so I went to the guild offices and in anticipation of that, but they didn't do that, but they walked around chanting, "We would get access sooner if it weren't for Roy Blunt Jr." Which I was just glad that my name did not rhyme with Satan or something.
But do you like your Kindle?
I don't like my Kindle. It's too, first of all, I like old books, you know. But I could see adjusting to the iPad because it looks more like it's a bigger screen and you turn pages like this and it doesn't have a whole lot of bells and whistles on it. And I know this is quaint, but when you download a book, when you go through iBooks and it's a whole separate thing from the other ways of downloading books. But they have lots of books on there and movies and stuff. At any rate, when you download a book, it goes to your little library. You have a little library, and your little library has this faux bookshelf. I mean, it actually looks like wood. Your bookshelf, and your book shows up on the library shelf like that. little picture of your book, and then you tap on your picture. But as I say, when I tapped on my picture today, it didn't come up for some reason. So.
It sounds a little bit like having a tofu burger or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Exactly. Yeah, it is very much like a tofu burger, I think. Yeah.
Let's talk about, it's always interesting to me when writers are performers as well. Is that, what side of your personality is that, or what is it about performing that you like versus being at the keyboard?
Well, performing, you get feedback, of course, and people respond. You don't want to get dependent on that, because you do have to sit there by yourself and write and not, you know, and just be your own audience. And so I try not to get addicted to audiences, except this one. I think I could get addicted to these people out here. Yes, thank you. we're going to give, by the way, we're going to give away two tickets to the Rock Bottom Remainders concert. So, and Lisa hasn't decided how to pick the people, so.
Neither has Roy.
So no, I haven't
we'll figure
either.
It out in the
yeah.
next 10 minutes. Why don't we talk about the Remainders now? Because
yeah.
that's what brings you to town this time in particular.
I'm back in 1992. The Kathy Goldmark in San Francisco was an author escort, which sounds, especially in San, when I say San Francisco,
that's what I want to be.
That sounds spicy, but it's the person who drives authors around when they're on a book tour and knows how to get to the radio station and knows how to, where to park and everything. And it's a great, great improvement on just trying to find your own way around every city you go to. So every city has author escorts. And she's also a musician, though, and performs with a band. And authors would come through, and they would say, oh, we wish we were in a band. And so she formed a band of authors back in 1992. And I was among, but I have no reason to be in the band because I can't play any instrument, and I'm a terrible singer. But I'll introduce the band. Kathy thought I could do a song called Ain't I My Dog, which is, I don't know why she thought I should sing that, but but at any rate, I tried to sing it, and Al Cooper, who was at that time our musical advisor, you know, formerly of Blood, Sweat, and Tears and various other things, is a very candid person, and he laid down various rules for us as members of the band. One was be at one with the oneness, and the other one was never do number two on the bus. He knew a lot. You know, he'd been in music for a long time. We traveled all over up and down the East Coast, putting on shows in Aretha's bus that had belonged to Aretha Franklin. We had a wonderful time. So I introduced the band, and then I don't do Ain't I'm a Dog. I do, on Wild Thing, I come in on You Move Me. That's my that's my solo. We used to have a thing called the Critics' Chorus. Matt Groening and Greil Marcus and a couple other people and me were the Critics' Chorus, whose job was sort of to remind everyone that this is not supposed to be a good band. And we would do things like short shorts, you know, and drop our pants, things like that, you know, things that
wow.
rock and roll needs and that lots of authors are too, you know, sort of have their nose too much up in the air to do. But the Critics' Corps would do that, but I'm the last vestige of the Critics' Corps. So, and I will come in on things. I will sing titles like Gloria, Gloria. That's about what I do, that's what I do.
I know a lot of writers wanted to be rock stars, but realized that wasn't going to work out.
Well,
writing is easy to break.
Right. No, I think musicians are the coolest people, I think. I've been around a lot of athletes and actors and people like that, but everybody wants to be a musician, I think. They also get along with each other, except for Al Cooper, but everybody else... musicians get together and they start jamming and stuff, I think, you know, whereas sometimes writers get together, but they're, until they know each other, you know, this may sort of be a little competitive. But I guess you can, musicians can be competitive and play at the same time with each other or something. I don't know. But everybody wants to be a musician, and I would love to be able to. I am, in fact, the national chairman of the League for the Singing Impaired, which and I wrote the definitive singing impaired song, if you'd like to hear it.
Yeah. Do you want to stand up?
It's best to applaud now than after I sing it. When you said you were on my side, you lied. When you said I'd be satisfied, you lied. When you said your love would abide, you lied. But when you said you'd hit me and knock out my tooth, you told the truth.
Can I download that on iTunes?
I don't think it will take.
Yeah. Was the band always from the beginning about raising money for charity? Or
yeah.
Was that something... That was the whole idea.
We had to have some reason other than
that.
Yeah. Yes, we've raised over $2 million for various literacy charities. And as I understand it, the money we're raising this time goes to Haiti to buy book, to
Haiti.
Replace the library. Haiti.
And to
Haiti.
The library as well, I think. Yeah.
Oh, to here too, yeah.
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 The money goes
wherever we go, we scatter goodwill and money.
Yes, that's good. So that's Thursday at the Electric Factory.
Mm.
We have got a couple of minutes to come up with a clever way to give out.
Yeah, what's the best way? Shall we? They all want them, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So
there are a lot of people.
Okay, so I guess we have to have, who knows the most famous musician who ever performed with the Rock Bottom? Hmm? No, not Dave Barry, no. Oh, who said it? Bruce Springsteen is right.
Wow.
Huh? Yeah.
Awesome. Want to come up and give Roy a hug now? Or come up and give him a hug now?
Oh, okay.
Good.
You didn't have to answer the question if you don't want to give me a hug. Well, I wish I had more tickets to give away.
I know. Beautiful women coming up from the stage.
We're the most famous author to perform with the Rock Bottom Rangers, who will not be with us this time, unfortunately, is Stephen King. Performing with Stephen King is a remarkable experience because people come up to the stage with their fingernails set on fire. Things, like that. Things that never happen when you're writing.
Things that you write.
Yeah.
Make you feel real goth.
Yeah.
I'll open it up to questions in just a second, but so get your questions ready, please. But I want to ask you, I'm about to publish a book in February, so I know that there's no future for me as a writer because the publishing industry is, you know, in turmoil. But I wondered if other authors out there in the audience, if you could give us newbies to books, book writing, some guidance.
Oh, me. Well, it depends on what... if you got a book coming out already, you're
I'm ahead of the
you're
game.
You're ahead of the game because it's hard to get anybody to publish anything. I think things will loosen up a little more, but the whole business is so up in the air. Nobody knows what books are going to look like from one day to the next, and publishers are not making much money. People are not buying books. I don't know. But that's probably true of every, just about every industry other than, hedge funds or something. I guess hedge funds are back doing well.
That's the best guidance, go into a hedge fund?
Yeah, go into a hedge first. And then don't quit your day job. I don't know. I mean, but one thing is that publishers are more and more depending on authors to promote, to market their own books, which I resent. But so anything you can do, just go out there and hustle your own book is it's going to be necessary to do because they don't advertise books as much as they used to, and I don't know the people don't review books as much. I mean, book review sections of newspapers are disappearing along with newspapers.
Right.
And there are a lot. Obviously, online is there now, and it's a great opportunity. I do not blog, and I do not Facebook or any of that stuff. But I think you probably should. You know, you should probably Twitter, tweet, do whatever you, editor. I just hope people, authors in the future will have time to actually write when they're not blogging and Twittering and tweeting and so on. I'm just too old for that. But people, I say that, but, you know, next, if I have to do it, I guess I'll do it. But I think that's what you have to do is just to push your book as hard as you can. And but people more and more want you to do things for free. You know, people call, unfortunately, a generation is growing up, I'm afraid, that doesn't expect to get paid for writing.
Right.
And that just irritates me no end. Because, you know, you got to make a living, you know, and you don't want writing to be in the hands of only people who have trust funds. So,
yes.
Not that trust fund people, trustafarians, they call them in New Orleans.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No, there's nothing wrong with a trust fund. If anybody has one out there, it's not too late for me to accept one if anybody wants.
Before I open up for questions, let's talk about your next book.
I have a book about the Marx Brothers coming out in October. I wrote a little book about the Marx Brothers movie Duck Soup. It's called Hail, Hail, Euphoria, which, you know, instead of Hail, Hail, Fredonia, which they sing a lot.
Yes.
And it's dredged up lots of new anecdotes about the Marx Brothers and one thing or another. It's just a wonderfully funny movie.
It was. It was.
Okay. Still is. Yeah.
Still is. Anybody out there have any questions? Oh, here's one right here. It doesn't sound it.
Doesn't sound
whoa,
it.
Whoa,
now it's on. Sorry. I very much enjoy your appearances on Wait, Wait, Don't Talk, Don't Tell Me. Can you comment on that? I admire your appearances there.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's a fun show to be on. You know, it's amazing. It's the most popular thing I've ever done. I mean, I've ever been a part of. I don't do it all, but it's so popular. This is a little bit, I'm sorry if this is a shocking analogy, but to me, lately, when we go and do it live in New Orleans and Austin and places, wonderful towns whose taste I respect, but they're so responsive, it's sort of like you're making love, you know, and the other person is just rolling around and bouncing around, and you think, well, I thought it was pretty good, but I didn't realize it was that good. You wonder whether there's something going on that you don't know about.
People pay a lot of money to see that show perform.
Yeah, they do when we come to towns and raise money for the local station. Yeah, it's great. And so it's become a huge hit. Unfortunately, it's on NPR, so, you know, I don't get anything, you know, much out of it.
It's another freebie, yeah.
Yeah.
It's good.
Not
approach.
A freebie. No, we do get paid.
You do get paid.
You know, Carl Castle, people ask me what Carl Castle is really like, and I say he is really like Carl Castle.
When we saw the show, people mobbed him afterwards.
Yeah, I know. He gets yeah. Yeah, hey.
Yeah.
Could you speak a little bit about what you found fascinating about edit, if you found it fascinating about editing Mark Twain's work?
Yeah, I've been a big Mark Twain fan since I was a kid. There's this book out from the Library of America, which I'm sort of the honorary editor of, but I helped to pick some of the pieces of it. It includes his book called A Tramp Abroad. It's his travel writings by Mark Twain. Mark Twain, one thing about Mark Twain is that nobody ever writes a parody of Mark Twain. Nobody ever takes off Mark Twain because it would be like writing a parody of your parents. You know, his voice is already in there. Everybody who writes in America derives from Mark Twain, pretty much. That's not so much true anymore. But, for you know, Ernest Hemingway said that all modern American literature comes from Huckleberry Finn. Because Mark Twain brought together the vernacular American speech with formal English. It just created a whole new way of telling a story that you see in, I don't know, Adventures of Augie March. Just for years, any sort of first-person narrative was derived from the voice of Huckleberry Finn. It proved that American speech was a great instrument for literature. So, you know, it's just like it's, he is part of our roots as American writers. And he is, he wrote a lot of great, he traveled all the time. He lived all over the world. And he traveled all over the world and he wrote about it. And he'd be writing, he was in Bombay, India, checking into a hotel. And the hotel guy who was taking him to his room ceremoniously passed by a worker who was polishing, or, you know, scrubbing something or something. And apparently he wasn't doing it right. So the hotel guy just absentmindedly slapped the worker, and the worker, and it took Mark Twain just said something like, "In a moment, I had been transported from Bombay, India to Hannibal, Missouri, where in my boyhood, where I saw a man hit a slave with a piece of brick and kill him." And people thought it was a shame. People in town thought it was kind of too bad, but nobody thought it was illegal because he had every right to kill his slave if he wanted to. So it's just, all you never know with Mark Twain. He's going to flash back and flash forward to something really surprising and something very, profound. He goes from being funny to being suddenly talking about embarrassing and gravely interesting things. So he's a really surprising writer all the time. Still surprising. Yeah. Oh.
Oh, right here and then right there. Let's take you first since you're closer.
Hi, I really love your writing. Maybe a little bit of a selfish question, but next month I'm going down to New Orleans. And upstairs I was looking for books on New Orleans, and lo and behold, your book. Are there any real secret places or your favorite surprise thing that nobody knows about when they go to New Orleans?
In New Orleans? A lot of the places, my favorite places were washed away, but lots of other places. I've just, if you've been, this is, I wrote a little book about New Orleans called Feet on the Street. Travels to New Orleans. And that came out before Katrina. Lots of those books were washed out to the Gulf, in fact. But the Tremé, if you started watching the Tremé series on HBO, The Wire, I just love The Wire, and the people who made The Wire are now doing a series called Tremé, which is about, Tremé is a neighborhood, you probably read about it, it's been reviewed all over the place, neighborhood in New Orleans where traditionally lots of local music came out of. My wife and I are in the fifth episode of Tremé. So we're in we have a cameo scene where we're sitting in a restaurant called Upper Line, which is, you may not, if you don't know Upper Line, that's a good place to go eat. It's a great restaurant, Upper Line. And we're sitting there, and John Goodman, who plays an angry New Orleanian right after Katrina, who gives it in the first episode of Tremé. John Goodman, who is just huge, you know, he's being interviewed by a sort of snotty British TV interviewer who says things like, "Well, you know, why not just let the city wash away? Why should we save the city?" And John Goodman gets more and more irritated and grabs the guy's microphone and throws it into the canal. So he's based on a real person in New Orleans who blogged more and more angrily after Katrina. And he comes into John Goodman's character comes into Upper Line, and I greet him and congratulate him on saying something that involves the F word six times, I believe. So in the context, in the course of telling you how much I admired in saying that, I say the F word 12 times, I guess.
Cable TV, not cable.
You can do anything on cable. Yeah. So.
What is your favorite city?
New Orleans is my favorite city. I love New Orleans because it still is local. You know, it's still got local music. It's still got local characters, local people. And it's a great place to eat.
You had mentioned Southern writers. I was wondering if you knew a Southern writer out of, I think it's Moreland, Georgia, that's quite a character, Louis Grizzard, if you have any stories from him.
No, I don't. I never met Louis Grizzard once. but we sort of came, he worked for the Atlanta papers after I did, and we never got to know each other at all. I don't, in fact, I'm not a big Louis Grizzard fan. People have said, somebody once called me the thinking man's Louis Grizzard, and I knew that my career was over. So mutually excludes just about every audience. But I don't have any Louis. That's the only Louis Grizzard story I have, actually.
I have one other question I didn't ask you. What's it like being married to an artist?
Well, I've talked her out of taking photographs of me in the bathtub. She doesn't see anything wrong with it. I said, I don't want to come out of it. She just tried it once, actually. But it's good. It's better, I think, maybe, than being married to another writer, because we have different, we enjoy a lot of the same things, but we also have different. She goes to her studio and paints, and I stay home and write, and so that we don't get in each other's way. I've talked to, this is not true anymore, but back when people used typewriters, I've talked to writing couples who both wrote at home, you know, and they'd be sitting there trying to think of something to say, and in the next room, their spouse would be going, click, 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 and it was hard on the marriage.
But she leaves the house and she's painting. So
yeah, she's off. Yeah, I don't know what she's doing. Yeah, she's she has a big studio in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, near where we live, and she goes there. And it's great stuff on the walls, you know.
Beautiful.
It decorates. An artist for a spouse will decorate your house.
Very nice.
Just sit around writing little spontaneous poems like that. I never,
she
never expected
you. Obviously.
Yeah. Sorry.
Do you wake up in the morning and write? What's your process?
I really don't have a process. I get up and if I have to get something done that day, I will go immediately to my computer, start working. But lots of times I put things off till later on in the evening, and I don't know. Once my first book I wrote after hanging out with the Pittsburgh Steelers for a season, I wrote a book about that, and I was single then. And I was able to, living by myself, and I was able to sleep from 9 to 5 and write all night, and it was great. If I could do that now, but it's hard to live like that, you know. And so I'm always just trying to, I do a lot of wandering around, and that's another reason it's good for one's spouse to be off doing something during the day, because I may just be standing out in the yard and apparently not doing anything, but I may be thinking. And I've found that spouses are irritated by that. I could be doing something useful.
You're dusting and thinking.
Yeah,
right?
I could be
if you're dusting,
right,
and thinking,
yeah.
It might be different.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Maybe I could get away with that.
Yeah, we can get your feather duster.
Just give me a feather duster and I'll walk around.
We have a question right there.
I've heard you tell this Sports Illustrated story about writing about Will Chamberlain.
Yeah.
I'd love you to tell it again.
Okay, do we have time for that? Okay.
I think so.
Well, I used to work for Sports Illustrated from 1968 to 1975. And at some point during that time, I was asked to go out to Bel Air, California, and write a story with Wilt Chamberlain. Wilt Chamberlain was a great basketball player, and he was going to announce that he was retiring from the game, from playing the game at any rate. And they needed somebody to be the as-told-to story, you know, Wilt Chamberlain as told to me. He was going to make this big announcement. It had to be a secret and everything. And so I went out there, and I don't know whether you remember Wilt Chamberlain. Wilt Chamberlain, in fact, was from Philadelphia, come to think of it. Yeah, forgot.
Oops.
Oh. That's a cute little ring.
We're done. No, we keep finishing your story.
Well, Chamberlain was from Philadelphia. At any rate, he was living in L.A., and he was living. But at any rate, if you don't know who he was about 7 feet tall, 7'1", something like that. And he was had been a great, overpowering basketball player. And he also was famous for having said in his autobiography that he had slept with 20,000 women. To me, that's what's impressive is breaking up with 20,000 women. That would take a lot out of a person, it seems to me. But anyway, he was there, and we worked together, and he was fine to work with. Not every athlete is very literate. You know, I mean, that's not to say. Well, anyway, Pete Rose, for instance, who was played for the Cincinnati Reds, once asked Pete, "Pete, how many books have you ever read?" And Pete gave that some thought and said, "I don't think I've ever read a book." Apparently, it hadn't occurred to him to think about it before, but he never read a book. His questioner said, "Well, Pete, you've written two." But that didn't count, I guess. So, you know, lots of times books supposedly written by athletes are sort of constructed by other people. But Wilt Chamberlain was talked, and even some people who talk very eloquently, when you write it down, it doesn't work all that well on the page. But Wilt spoke in complete sentences, and you could write it down and, you know, fiddle with it a little bit and rearrange it a little bit, and it went well. We didn't have any problem working together. Problem was that he had done a story for Sports Illustrated like this, an as-told-to story before, and he felt he had been misrepresented by the headline, and so he had this agreement that he had to approve every word in the text and also every word in the headlines. So that was fine with me. But he was there. He had a house in Bel Air that had its ceilings considerably higher than these. And, I mean, it was. And it also had a feature of decor that I've never seen in anybody else's house. He had wolf muzzles, wolf muzzle upholstery, wolf muzzle carpeting. Wolf muzzles are like the fur from, you know, lots of these. Well, you know, I don't know how he came by them. I guess his interior decorator, I'm sure they were roadkill.
Woman number 17,456 was right. Into wolf muzzles.
Into wolves, probably. Right. And so they were sort of intimidating, the wolf muzzles. And also his friends were there. And his friends were not as big as he was, but they were big enough to be his friends. And they were sort of milling around, watching me, eyeing me like a hawk, so that I didn't take advantage of Wilt. And I was. So he approved all the text. It was fine. But then the headlines. In those days, we didn't have faxes or computers. We had a thing that Hunter Thompson called a mojo machine, which you could put a type sheet of paper in, big old heavy thing you had to carry around. You put a piece of paper in it, and it would transmit it very slowly to another mojo machine back at your magazine's base, which was in New York. So I had the mojo machine there, and the editor had to send me through the mojo machine the headlines. Now, the first headline came in, the subhead, the big head said, the main headline said, quote, "My impact will be everlasting." And that was fine with Wilt. He approved that. He felt that was commensurate with his stature. And that was fine. But his friends were walking around, you know, just sort of milling around, just sort of waiting for me to make a false move. And then the subhead came in, and it said, "A dominant force in basketball announces his retirement from the game." And I pulled it out of the machine, and I handed it up to Wilt to read. And he said, "A dominant force." And I said, "Well, you know, I think the operative words there are dominant and force. I mean, you were certainly dominant, forceful, and all that." And he said, "A dominant force?" And I said, "Well," and his friends now were saying, "A dominant force? Man, A dominant? Man, it was dominant. What, A dominant? Come on." And I said, well, you apparently you would prefer the dominant. And he said, yes, he would. So, but I could see that the dominant wasn't going to fit. So I called back to New York, to the Time and Life building, which was where, in those days, where Sports Illustrated was, and to get the editor. And I said, I'm here with Wilt, and he doesn't want a dominant. He wants the dominant. And the editor wasn't there. But we had this miraculous telephone operator named Muriel, who
we're
could...
We're getting the cane in just a minute.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay, right quick. Muriel could find anybody, anywhere, and maybe I should tell the rest of the story later. Can I have one?
No,
Muriel could find anybody anywhere, and she said, but, and she also wouldn't take anything off of anybody. So she found this one time, the managing editor hung up his phone loudly, and Muriel said, Andre Laguerre was his name, and she rang him back and said, Andre, if everybody in the building whanged his receiver, I would have to have brain surgery. So he never whanged his receiver. Never whanged his receiver again. So, but when Muriel found the editor, he was in this bar called the Ho-Ho, which in which every fourth drink was free, which meant that you didn't hardly pay not to have eight. So the editor was in about his sixth or seventh drink, and he was saying, I don't know. And I would say, I'm here with Wilt. And the guys, Wilt's friends, were milling around saying things like, thing I don't see is you come into a man's home and call him a dominant. I was sitting on the couch, and the wolf muzzles were sort of bristling up underneath. So I said, and I couldn't get anything out of the editor, so I handed the phone up to Wilt and said, you'll just have to talk to him yourself. So Wilt said, I know what the word dominant means. I know what the word force means. That's not the point. My point is, yes. And to my astonishment, I was hearing Wilt gradually mollified, and he finally agreed to the headline. They handed me back. And I looked up at him, and he said, who the hell is Muriel? Thank you. I'm sorry.
No. You're going to be signing books upstairs.
Yes,
and coming out to the show on Thursday night at the Electric Factory, 8 o'clock.
Thank you, Lisa.
Sorry.
No.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.